Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hello.
We've got an interesting story lined up for us today. And this is one of those kind of stories, you know, we've talked about this on the show since its inception, back in, what, 1812 when we first started?
I believe it was, yeah. Yeah, 1812.
The whole concept of I know a murderer. And we've been surprised and not surprised, unfortunately, in many of the cases and instances of these type of stories. And even you and I, when we started posing that question, we're like, man, it's crazy how many people are associated or know a murderer. Mm-hmm. And then it hit both of us between the eyes that we, too, are in that position. Mm-hmm. So it is strange and terrifying to realize there is no real 6 degrees of separation anymore when it comes to violent crimes and murder. It seems there's somebody right around the corner. Even though we don't hear about all of these murders in a public way all the time, or in our area, we don't always hear about something that took place in Pennsylvania or Massachusetts or California, but these stories continue to exist, and there are monsters out there on a regular basis doing horrible things. And our story today kind of crosses a lot of what we discuss on the show and the I Know a Murderer faction in a very unique perspective and very unique way. Joining us on the line right now is Lisa Espich, and she is the daughter of Richard Bruns. Welcome to the show, Lisa. Thank you for being here today.
Hi, Dave and Tim. Thanks for having me.
Boy, this is, you know, it's like one of those kind of deals. I want to put this house of cards together nicely, and it's, you know, I want to jump in on certain points, but it's like, I know then it begets right away to the butler did it. But talk to me about 10 years ago, you and your sister discovered something, and talk to us a little bit about that day and what happened.
Well, it was myself and my two sisters, and we were all at my mother's home going through boxes of old photos. And in the middle of one of these boxes was a typewritten manuscript that I pulled out, titled Aya Squealer, and it was authored by my father. And when I pulled it out, I asked my mom, what's this? And she said, oh, well, that's the book your father wrote about his experience when he was 20. And I didn't know anything about the book. I didn't know he had ever written anything. And so she told me to go ahead and take it with me. And I read it after I got home and was really blown away by what I had just discovered. And it reminds me of like the bridges of Madison County, where you're, you know, finding out something about a parent, but instead of it being this love story that you don't know about your parent, it was more of a much more gruesome story that my father was involved in. And it was really eye-opening and quite a find. And I took it to my father and showed him that I had it. And I think he was really thrown at first because he probably assumed, because this had now been in a box for 40 years. He wrote this in the late 60s. And he, I'm sure, assumed that it had been tossed out by now. He didn't know it still existed. And so he was shocked to see it. And I ended up giving it back to him. And at that time, I really encouraged him that he should, you know, put this out for people. It turns out this is a very famous murder that happened, and it's his side of it. And I felt that he should put it out there. At the time, he really just wanted it back. And more time passed. And then just a few years ago, about 2 years ago, because of things that were happening, we were able to convince my father to finally share his side of the story.
Was this, and we'll get into the murder and that whole aspect of it, but not knowing your dad's affiliation with any of this, were you familiar with the story? Were you familiar with the murder? Was this something that was famous and well known in your area?
So I was familiar with murder because I did know that my father had a friend that was a murderer. That's something that I did know growing up. And I knew little bits of it, but I never knew just how involved he really was with this person and the cases. And so it was extremely enlightening to find out just how close he was with all of this and how connected he was with the cases. That I didn't realize he was that involved.
All right. So we've kind of set this stage. You read this book yourself. You look at it. Is it kind of a gut punch to you to see and know deeper insights into this case than you ever imagined?
Yeah, I think it definitely was emotional to read that. And, you know, my father, I think one of the things that really surprised me was just how amazingly he was able to put down his emotions on paper. And that's difficult to do. So I first of all thought, wow, he's an amazing writer. Why didn't he become a writer with his life? Because I felt like, wow, this is a great read. And then to see and understand the things that my father went through as a young man, more than anything, I really felt what he had been through, and not knowing that he had been through this, I really had a new understanding of my father, and I guess a real empathy for what he went through and how difficult this time must have been.
And when you confront him, did he seem angry or ashamed, or how would you explain his demeanor?
I do feel that I'm not angry at all, but I do feel that this was really a very dark part of his past that I do clearly see now that he wanted it to disappear. You know, he dealt with a lot after this happened, and I think that he really was always afraid of maybe us knowing all of the details. And so I think it was more of, I guess maybe like a shame, but more, you know, I want this back, maybe kind of embarrassed that we now knew so much more than we knew before. And, you know, at this point now, I'm already in my 40s when I read it. So we had gotten through our whole lives and not really known too much about it, which really, when I think back, is amazing because there's so much online about these cases. And I never really, my sisters and I never really looked into the cases online. But if we had been interested, you know, we would have seen a lot about these cases online and a lot about my father's involvement. But we didn't. And we really didn't know much about it. And I think that he was content with us not knowing a whole lot about it. At the same time, I know that he always kind of worried about that part of his past affecting us and affecting our family and people knowing about it. So it was like a dark secret in his past that he always wished didn't exist.
How long, and let's now take this back into time, how long was he friends with this man? And Schmidt is, I remember the last name. The first name is Charles,
Charles,
right?
Schmidt. Yeah, Charles Schmidt.
Right. How long had he known Charles Schmidt?
Well, he had first met him when he was 15 and Charles Schmidt was 18. And they weren't really close friends when they first met. They were just acquaintances. And then they became much closer friends in the last 2 years before this all blew up. So he really was a close friend with Charles Schmidt about a year and a half to 2 years. And so it wasn't a long time, but it was, they did get very close in their friendship during that time.
All right. And were there red flags throughout the friendship that he could see in hindsight of what kind of guy Charles really was? Or did this seem to blindside your dad as well?
Initially, when he first met Charles Schmidt, no. And so he remembers Charles Schmidt as a very charismatic, very popular guy that a lot of people followed and hung around. And he was, you know, good looking, athletic. He came from a well-off family, and so he had a lot of things. He had a brand new car when my dad first met him. He had lots of money. His parents gave him a $300 a month allowance, which in 1965 would have been an amazing amount of money for a young man to have. And so he was just this really great guy to hang out with and be friends with. Over time, he did start to evolve and get odd in his behavior and in the way he dressed. And he took on kind of a new persona in those last couple years, actually probably the last 1 year that my dad really was friends with him. he really mostly evolved after the initial first killing. And then my father saw him really, really start to spiral into somebody else. But initially, no, he did not see those signs at first, but definitely saw it evolving and happening.
Now, your father's not aware that his friend is involved in murders when the first murder happens, correct?
He is aware of it about 3 months after it happens. So
now,
about
Charles' personality leading up to this, was it, you know, it was the 60s. Was he dabbling in drugs and experimenting? Is this what started, do you believe, down this weird, dark path?
They did drink. My father said that he has no recollection of drugs ever being a part of Charles Schmid. You know, my father didn't do drugs and he didn't remember Charles Schmid ever doing drugs, but they did drink and there were a lot of parties with a lot of drinking. If there was drugs, my father doesn't recall that.
Okay. So once, talk to me about this first murder and what year was this, 1965?
So in 1964, May 31st, 1964 was the first murder. And Charles Schmid started, so the understanding is that Charles Schmid started wanting to see what it was like to murder someone. There was a friend that Charles Schmid had that he, John Saunders, who he convinced to do this killing with him. And Charles Schmid had actually created a list of girls that might be possible victims. Charles Schmid had a girlfriend named Mary French that he convinced to lure one of these girls out. And so they had, between the three of them, so Charles Schmid had convinced Mary French and John Saunders to go through with this killing with him. They narrowed the list down to one girl, Aline Rowe. And one night, Mary French went out, and Aline Rowe's mother, she was a single mother that worked at a hospital here in Tucson. And so after the mother left to go to work, they knew that Aline would be on her own. And Aline lived just a couple houses away from Mary French. So they were friends in the neighborhood and from school. So she went to Aline Rowe's window and convinced Aline to come out with them, with Charles Schmid, John Saunders, and her, to go out and drink beer or hang out. And so she did convince her to do that. And they ended up going out to the desert, supposedly to drink beer. And they ended up murdering her. So Mary French was in the car, but they had lured Aline down into a wash area. And they raped her and then ended up hitting her over the head with a large rock and killed her. And then the three of them ended up burying her and left. And that was the first murder.
All right. Now, see, that's always been aspects of the story that terrify me the most. To know that there's one broken individual is scary enough. To know that there might be a few people that would share the same mind and in the same town at the same time, weird. But that they're friends.
Yeah.
And then that you've got three of them. And say that again, there were two guys and one girl involved in this?
Right. So there was Charles Schmid, another guy, John Saunders, and then Charles Schmid, one of his girlfriends at the time, Mary French. So it was the three of them, and they lured this girl out. And the one thing that I've really learned in all of this is that Charles Schmid, it's almost uncanny how much of a following he had and how he seemed to be able to manipulate people. And, you know, when my father talks of John Saunders, what he knew of John Saunders, he doesn't believe that John Saunders would ever, you know, have done anything like this, and felt like, you know, he really kind of got wrangled into it. But even to get wrangled into something like this, it's just amazingly, you know, bizarre to think that you could get two other teenagers to do this with you. But he did.
Yeah, I mean, did they discuss or did Charles give any indication to your dad what spurred this conversation? How do you go from, oh boy, that neighbor girl pisses me off, to, you know what, we should rape and kill her? I mean, how does that evolution even happen?
Well, clearly Charles Schmid had some things going on mentally leading up to that, because he knew that he wanted to kill someone. He wanted to see what it felt like to kill someone. That's where this all stemmed from. Somehow he did talk John Saunders into following through with him on this. Now, I don't know what those conversations were between Charles and John, and my father doesn't know either, but he does know that this was Charles Schmidt's idea that he talked John into doing with him, and then somehow was able to get Mary French in on it too. And I don't know, I don't know how, you know, two teenagers get, you know, sucked into doing this. And I don't know if they didn't really think that it was going to really happen, and it ended up really happening, but it is a really scary aspect of this, that you had three teenagers all doing this together. And this was prior to Manson, where, you know, you think about, you know, young people all getting together to do something. And so this was the first time, you know, anything like this was known to happen, you know, and then to happen in such a small town like Tucson, it was just quite shocking.
Okay. So these two compatriots, do they end up cracking, breaking? Are they feeling the pressure of what they've done? Is Charles Schmidt feeling any guilt and remorse over this? You know, is any of this information given to your father regarding this? And 3 months after the fact, how does the subject get broached to your dad?
Well, so right after it happened, shortly after it happened, both John Saunders and Mary French left Tucson. So John Saunders went to another state, and so did Mary French, because of family things, they left. And that's when my father and Charles Schmidt started hanging out more. So my father really started hanging out more often with Charles Schmidt after this all happened. And they were hanging out at a city park, and Charles Schmidt ended up telling him how this went down and how he killed this girl. Everybody knew Aline Rowe was missing, and she was believed to be a runaway. And there were a lot of runaways from Tucson at that time. Charles Schmidt was a very big storyteller and was always telling far-fetched stories. And so while my father believed that Charles Schmidt maybe could have done something like this, I don't think at that point he really believe that this happened. You know, it was at that point he believed that Charles Schmidt was telling his tall tales. And, you know, so I think he was torn on what he believed and what he didn't believe. But Charles Schmidt didn't give him any specifics as far as where the body was or any details that he could go to the police with. But he definitely at that point realized, okay, I'm hanging out with somebody who, you know, may have very well killed this girl. And he did start to see Charles Schmidt evolving at that point into kind of acting more odd and doing odd things. But he hung on to the information. And I do like to remind people that this was in 1964. And at that time, you know, you don't have DNA. You don't have, you know, the cell phone records like we have now and the computers that we have now. So I think back as a 19-year-old man, you know, nowadays, if somebody came to me and told me that they killed somebody, I would probably feel pretty confident that if I went to the police, that they'd be able to figure it out from there. But this was a different time. And if you didn't have specifics, there, you know, the police had already questioned all of the, you know, I do like to remind people, if you think back to that time.
We lost you there for a second. You said the police had already questioned, and then your audio ditched out on you for a few seconds.
Yeah.
They had spoken to all the kids and the people around at that time?
Yeah, and so they had no evidence. Nobody knew what happened to her. So, you know, at that time, my father, you know, was afraid to go to the police, and what, you know, he didn't have any real answers. It was just a story at that point, and he felt a far-fetched story.
But he didn't. So Charles didn't give the specifics of who it was that they murdered.
He did. He did tell him that it was Aline Rowe, who was believed to be a runaway. And so part of my father's belief was that Charles Schmidt was turning this into a tall tale and didn't necessarily believe that he had killed her. but also okay. didn't have any specifics of where the body was or anything like that to go to the police with. And he hung on to that. He didn't go forward with anything at that point.
But he felt it was okay to still keep hanging out with him. Was it more of a, like, keep your friends close and your enemies closer? Do you get that kind of vibe from your dad, that he knew this kid was kind of off and it might be better to stay on his good side?
Yeah, I do believe that that came later when he had evidence that he really had murdered. But I think at this point, when he's first told the story, I think he's torn on whether he believes Charles Schmid is really telling the truth or just making a far-fetched story, because Charles Schmid was such a storyteller. And so I think my dad at this point kind of was blowing it off and not really believing that he had truly killed Aline Rowe.
Did you talk to your dad about some of these aspects as well? Because, all right, I get the idea. We've all had that friend that's a tall tale spinner, and we'll have yarns to spin and share these tales with us, you know. And Tim and I are out at the bar, and Tim's telling me how lucky he got with these triplets last night. I may internally question how real the story is, but there's still that possibility it is. And that's a fun kind of goofy story to share with your buddies. But if Tim starts spinning a yarn to me about how he raped and murdered a girl, and you know, to me, that just seems like a less interesting person to want to kind of remain friends with. Did your dad give any indication of, you know, even if this guy's just lying, if that's the kind of sick fantasies he's having or the kind of stories he wants people to believe he's capable of, why would your father even have an interest in remaining friendly with this guy?
You know, as I read through my father's story and I think back to the time and I look at what following Charles Schmid had, I think that just as many teenagers were manipulated and sucked into these friendships with Charles Schmid, my father was as well. I think that there was a lot of benefit to having a friend that was so popular, surrounded by so many people and girls and, you know, had so much, that I think as a young man that he got sucked into that as well. And so I think that when I look back, I can see that happening, that it was more maybe not wanting to really face who this person really is, because, you know, you've created this friendship with this really supposedly cool, popular guy that everybody wants to be around, and you're a part of that. And that's what I think initially was happening there. But pretty quickly after that, he started to really start to change, Charles Schmid did. And then it was a pretty short time after that my father did, as you say, start to get more cautious and trying to keep your friends closer because you're afraid of what they're going to do.
All right. How many murders in total does Charles Schmid end up committing during his little run?
So we know for sure that there are three girls, but there may have been a fourth girl. There was a fourth girl that...
Well, we'll get to that then. Hold on. We'll get okay. to the fourth. But let's go to what we know to be the facts, the first three. So we've heard the first. How long after the first murder does Charles Schmid do and conceive the second murder?
It's a little more than a year later. So Aline Rowe was murdered May 31st, 1964. The next two girls were murdered August 16th of the following year, 1965. Now, the circumstances are quite a bit different in this, because one of the girls, Charles Schmid, was dating. And so Charles Schmid had been dating a girl named Gretchen Fritz for quite a long time at that point, for almost a full year. And at one point, he had decided that he was going to take Gretchen out and show her where Aline Rowe's body was buried. And so he took his girlfriend Gretchen out to see where the body was. And at that point, Gretchen started holding it over his head. So she almost like was blackmailing him with it. And so she started trying to control everything he did, as far as he had to be home at a certain time. And, you know, she
needed to know. Wait a minute. So, okay. You find out was he bragging to his girlfriend that he had raped and murdered another girl?
Well, clearly,
or was this just kind of an out of the blue, hey, you want to see a secret and then take her to the site? I mean, what was...
Well, it's pretty obvious that he was somebody who had to somehow share, you know, what he had done. You know, he told my dad pretty quickly after, 3 months later, and then ends up taking Gretchen out there. I don't know how many other people he had told or possibly taken out there, but he, you know, I guess in some way was bragging or wanting her to see what kind of guy he was. You know, who knows why he would have done that, but somehow felt that he was close enough with her to take her out there and do that. And then it's, you know, also shocking that, you know, the response, instead of going straight to the police, the response is, you know, to use that as kind of blackmail. But she did start holding it over his head and started, you know, kind of trying to control him with that, and kept saying that if he didn't do things a certain way, she would go to the police. And eventually they kept arguing.
So she's so psycho. She's making the psycho seem normal. So she gets this information, and instead of what any, I would believe, red-blooded human would do, go to the police or break up, she decides, well, I own this guy now. He's mine. Right. I'm never going to lose him.
Right. And
what
that's what...
What is in the water in that town?
I know. And that's what really makes this all so bizarre and crazy. When you look back at this time and kind of what everybody was, you know, what was everybody thinking, really? But that's what happened. And so he ended up eventually, you know, they kept arguing and arguing. And one night... He was having a party at his house, and there were a lot of witnesses that he picked up the phone, got into an argument with Gretchen, hung up the phone, very upset, and left with another individual. And that was the night that Gretchen and Wendy was her younger sister. So Gretchen and her younger sister, Wendy, had gone to a drive-in movie and never came home that night. And that was the night that he killed Gretchen and Wendy.
All right. Now, where does he go? What does he do? Where does he take them? What's the story behind that? Without too gruesome, but I mean, to give everybody right. The facts and understanding.
Well, we know where their bodies ended up. But the thing with Gretchen and Wendy is that Charles Schmid never admits to killing Gretchen and Wendy. And so nobody except... people involved with the murders ever really knew exactly how it happened. We know that Gretchen and Wendy went to the drive-in movie that night, and we know that they never came home. Their car ended up being found at a hotel here in town, and then the bodies ended up out in the desert. But there's no story that was ever really truly told, because he never admitted to it. Now, when I say he never admitted to it, he never admitted to the police that this happened. But he did eventually tell my dad that he had killed the sisters. And this is when my dad started realizing, okay, this guy really is a murderer.
That's got to be a chilling aspect. And like you said, you know, this guy seemed to kind of pride himself. It really makes you wonder how many other people like your father are out there that knew this story.
Yeah, I know that
the nature of these crimes, but were terrified, or almost in a Manson-like way, kind of found it alluring or interesting, so that they kept it quiet. And this was a small town. This is not so much different from like a Mayberry, right? I mean, this is small town 60s America.
Yeah, Tucson, Arizona at that time. You know, I think there were 300,000 people, which, I mean, it's not tiny, tiny, but it's, you know, not a huge city. Did I lose you?
No, I'm just listening to you as you're explaining.
Sorry.
Yeah.
I just had a weird sound. Sorry about that. So it was a small town, and it was, you know, when you think of 1960s, it was still a very innocent time, and it's the last place in the world anyone would have thought something like this would happen. And there are a lot of reports about, you know, after the fact, you know, there was a lot of beer cans and things that were found in the desert area after the bodies were discovered. And, you know, there's a lot of belief that there were more people than, you know, that knew about it than you would like to think.
Did your dad, I mean, obviously he was willing to kind of talk out loud about Schmid, but does he implicate anybody else or know who else would have been out there seeing these sites?
He does not implicate anyone else, but I have my own theories and reading everything that Charles Schmid was 5'3" and he was not a big guy. And, you know, to kill two teenage girls, what we do know from the court cases and from the witnesses when the court hearings happened is that he did leave with another man, and that man was quite a large man. And they both left together, and they both came back together early in the morning. And when the car was found at the hotel, if you look at the picture, it's really interesting because the driver's seat is pushed really far back. So you think, unless somebody did that intentionally, whoever parked that car there had to be a pretty tall person, and that was not Charles Schmid. And so I personally think, in looking at all of this, it's hard to believe that that other person didn't at least know something. But he's never implicated in the end when it comes to the court hearings and everything. But we do know that he left and came back with Charles Schmid that night. And so I just don't know myself why that was never looked at more closely.
Well, have you ever brought that to law enforcement to examine? There's no statute of limitations on murder. And if there's information that could implicate a second person, would that be something that you think should be followed up?
So actually, there is a person here in town in Tucson that after the book came out, contacted myself and my father, and he's actually the one that pointed out the seat, you know, being pushed back, and he actually is doing a lot of research and is in contact with the Tucson police and does believe that there are things that are going to be reopened up about these cases. And he's hoping. So there is already some stuff that's being looked at, whether or not they ever will reopen the cases. But I do know that he's involved in that. And so I do think it's something that they are looking at.
All right. Well, now you mentioned that these are the three murders that we're aware of. You think that there was a fourth murder that actually happened between the first and the second and third, correct?
Yes. So there, between Aline and between the sisters, there was another girl who went missing around the same age, and nobody knows whatever happened to her. And she supposedly was a runaway as well. But with the timing and, you know, everything that happened, there's speculation that, you know, there might have been that fourth victim, but never any proof of it. But my understanding is, and this is coming from that researcher here in town, that there were remains recently found that could be that missing girl. And so that's very interesting.
Wow, that is. Why do you think he would cop kind of to these other murders, but not to that one?
Well, so there's a bit that leads up to it. He did confide in my father that he killed the sisters. And then shortly after he confided in my father that he killed the sisters, the mafia at that time in Tucson, the Bonanno crime family, which is one of the, you know, big five crime families, was living here in Tucson. Joe Bonanno was, Gretchen's father was Joe Bonanno's heart surgeon. So shortly after Gretchen and Wendy went missing, Joe Bonanno got involved in trying to help find where Gretchen and Wendy went. And Charles Schmid, who was dating Gretchen, and my father, who everyone knew, hung out with Charles Schmid, the mafia came and picked the two of them up one night and took them to an apartment and questioned them about the two girls to try and figure out what happened to them. Well, of course, nothing was said at that point, and my dad just kept saying he didn't know anything. And Charles Schmid kept saying that he believed the girls had run away to California. But after they got dropped off that night, my father, you know, said to Charles Schmid, you know, what are we going to do? You've got the mafia involved in this. He was very scared about, you know, all of a sudden, you know, he's being questioned by the mafia, and, you know, it just really freaked him out. And Charles Schmid told my father at that time that the bad thing is he never buried the bodies. And my father said to him, you know, if you never buried the bodies, and he looked at that as his opportunity to see if this was really true. Because at this point, still, he has no proof and doesn't know, are these all far-fetched stories or what's going on here? And he told Charles Schmid, if you didn't bury the bodies, we need to go out there and bury them. And it was really, he saw it as his window of opportunity to, you know, find out, is this true? Well, sure enough, Charles Schmid does take him out to the bodies that are out in the desert. And then they attempt to try and bury them because that's what they went out there to do. Well, once my father attempted to help bury the bodies, which they were unsuccessful because the desert ground was so rocky and hard. But Charles Schmid at that point convinced my father that he was in it as deep as he was now. And so my father did believe at this point, now he knows the bodies are there. Now he knows Charles Schmid killed these two girls. But if he goes to the police, he believes that he's going to go to prison as well, because he tried to help bury the bodies. And Charles Schmid has him convinced that he's in it as deep as he is now. And so now he's trying to figure out what to do. And at that point, he's convinced that Charles Schmid has his sights on the girl that my father's in love with. And so my father starts to watch over this girl.
Yikes.
Yeah. So he starts to watch over this girl day and night to try and protect her, because he's afraid to go to the police, because now he tried to help bury the bodies with Charles Schmid, you know, believes he's going to go to prison as well. But now thinks that he's the only one that's going to be able to protect this other girl from being murdered. And so my father admits that he went, you know, a little crazy in trying to protect this girl. And, you know, when he thinks back, he was out of his mind at that point, because he didn't know what to do. He was scared to death and really believed that he was going to be the only one that could save this girl from being killed.
I'm sorry, mind blown here. I don't know. I don't want to sound dismissive. This is your dad, but wouldn't the best way to have protected the woman that he loves to maybe go to the police and say, hey, this is what happened. I helped bury the bodies so that I could actually prove that he knew where this was, and I did this, and I didn't want to end up next to those bodies. But now that I have your proof, here's where this took place. Here's what happened. Wouldn't that have been the best way to protect?
Well, of course. He looked back and he looks back as well and realizes that he kind of went out of his mind in doing, you know, when you read about going out there to bury the bodies. First of all, it was a horrific scene. And, you know, even seeing that and facing that and moving bodies that have been, you know, dead for a certain amount of time, you know, I think that my dad was in a very bad mental place at that point himself, and just was scared, was confused, was probably, you know, going through post-traumatic stress, not the most constructive way.
You cut out again for us. You'd mentioned that you think that your father was going maybe through some form of post-traumatic stress disorder, having seen this and had to cover this up. Does he detail that in the book of what it was like to, you know, was it kind of, and I don't mean this in a euphoric way, but was it kind of a thrill and this kind of a burst of adrenaline and excitement to realize that he's there, he's got these two bodies, he sees that he's helping to bury them. You know, what was it like for your father? What was that experience?
I think it was more being stuck in like a long drawn out nightmare. And he started having a recurring nightmare that Charles Schmid was killing this girl that he was in love with. And he really, And he admits that he became very obsessed with watching over this girl to the point that it was scaring everybody on the street. You know, they would call the police. They thought that he was, you know, they thought that this guy is obsessed with their daughter, and the police kept, you know, telling him to get off the street. And he was just afraid of her ever getting out of his sights. And then when he was sleeping, he was having nightmares that Charles Schmid was killing her. So he was stuck in this really, you know, nightmare situation that he, for whatever reason, did not feel that he could, you know, trust that he could go to the police and not end up in prison the rest of his life. And part of that was Charles Schmid had him convinced that he would go to prison the rest of life for doing that. And so, you know, he felt like, well, if I watch over her, he can't do anything to her. And that's what he was doing. Eventually, the police have my father, they get it so that the courts have him sent out of state. And so the courts send my father to Columbus, Ohio, to be with his grandmother. And it really wasn't until then, a few days after he's sent to Columbus, Ohio, when he realizes he has no control over what Charles Schmid does now. He can't watch over this girl. And that's when he finally calls the police and tells them what happened. But until then, you know, until he was pulled, and when I think back, thank God that the courts got him out of state, because who knows how far this would have kept going and what might have happened. And so at that point, my father contacted the police because he knew that he couldn't do anything to control what Charles Schmid was doing.
What was that like to have that final realization? This has to happen now. I've got to make this call, knowing that I may be implicating myself, that I may be going to jail.
And so what I gather from reading what he wrote and from talking to him is at that point, he didn't care anymore. So once he was, you know, and I think it's like anything, when you're pulled out of the situation and you're able to look at reality instead of being in the middle of it, he knew that he had no choice but to put a stop to this. And so at that point, and he did expect, you know, when he came back to Tucson, he fully expected he was going to end up, you know, going to jail. That didn't happen, but he was prepared for that because he knew, you know, that's probably what was going to happen once he called the police. But he was so afraid of what Charles Schmid was going to do with this other girl that he finally did do that. And it only took a few days of him being pulled away from the situation before his senses kind of got knocked back into him.
All right. He makes that call. What is it like? I mean, how do the police respond? Do they take him seriously at first? Or is this, you know, did it take some convincing to make them believe that he knew what was really going on, where these bodies were, who did it?
They believed him right away and sent. So one of the detectives from Tucson came to Cincinnati, Ohio. They came and picked him up the next morning, flew him back to Tucson that night.
And again, tell us, what is the time span? How long after these crimes does your father finally come forward?
So Aline Rowe was murdered May 31st, 1964. He knew about it about 3 months later. So that would have been like July of 1964. The Fritz sisters were murdered August 16th, 1965. And my father was sent to Columbus, Ohio in November. And within a few days is when, so it was like mid-November that he ended up calling the police, August, June, July. So a few months, like 3 months after the sisters were killed is when he called the police.
Okay. And he had to sit on that and just let that eat at him like a cancer. That has to be, I can't even begin to understand the burden that your father was carrying at that time.
Yeah. I think, you know, and it's true. You can look back and, you know, when I reflect back, I realize this was a young man who was caught up in a friendship, in a twisted situation, was very afraid for his own safety in life, was afraid of going to prison himself,
right.
Was afraid, you know, so I think it's easy to sit back and judge what you would or wouldn't do. But, you know, in reading my father's story and how he puts it down on paper and gets his emotions down, I see how, you know, somebody young could get caught up in all of this and get stuck.
Right. No doubt. It's real easy on the outside. And we've talked about this, Tim, before on the show, right? Of, well, I would have immediately done this or I would have done that. And until you're in that moment of terror and panic and fear for yourself and your family's lives, this guy is obviously shown.
Mm-hmm.
Tim, right? I mean, if this was me, would you immediately run to the police? Or knowing that I might get wind that you're going to go to the police, I might hurt somebody that you love. Do you think that still might make you hesitate?
I'm sure there'd be some hesitation. Yeah. I mean, it's something where you definitely have to, you got to think over your options, one. And two, there is that moment of panic where I don't think you make an immediate decision. No.
Yeah, so for all of you out there rolling your eyes and, oh, this guy's, he should have been put away. He knew. There's a lot going on in the story, and until you're in that kind of situation, feeling the pressure and fear and knowing, and again, it was a different time. It was a different era. It was probably, even though your father was aware of this, it still had to be almost impossible to wrap your head around, oh, my God, this is real.
Yeah.
This has happened.
And he even writes about, you know, there was a lot of time. So I can't even imagine. I mean, he writes about it, but I can't even imagine what it must have been like to go out into a desert and move bodies that, you know, had been there for about a month. And, you know, he talks about the smell and everything that was going on. And, you know, he later talks about how, you know, part of him never allowed himself to believe it was real. Like, you know, he never even wanted to believe that was real, that was, you know, I think that there is a part in your brain that when things are so traumatic and so shocking, I don't know what that can do to somebody's mind. And that's why I say, you know, at that time, post-traumatic stress syndrome was not something that I don't even think was, you know, existed as far as a diagnosis.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I think back at what he went through, and then once this was all done, he was supposed to just move forward and never received any, you know, treatment or help or, you know. And so, you know, I think that is something that just sat with him, you know, in his mind for a long time. So who knows what that does to, you know, being paranoid and being, you know, scared. And I just can't imagine.
No. So when he comes forward, they bring him back. He uncovers this information. How is law treating your dad? Are they looking at him as a criminal? Are they looking at as an informant? What is the overall feel towards his status?
So the police treated him very well, and they treated him more as an informant. And, you know, he took them straight to the bodies and, you know, was very honest with everything at that point and, you know, got everything down on statements. And, you know, and he knew that John Saunders and Mary French, according to Charles Schmid, were involved in the first murder. So they were able to extradite the two of them back into Tucson to face charges. And both Mary French and John Saunders admitted to their part of the killing. And so that made it really easy to know that Aline Rowe was definitely murdered by Charles Schmid and the two of them. And so then the Gretchen and Wendy Fritz cases, because Charles Schmid never admitted to anything, when my father, so when they took my...
So now the other two, in the first murder, have not been willing to come forward and confess. They're not willing to state that part of the story. Does your father implicate them because he knew it, or does Charles Schmidt implicate them, and how does it unfold from there?
So my father, because Charles Schmidt did tell him when he told the story of Aline Rowe to my father, he did tell him that Mary French and John Saunders were a part of that. So my father shared that with the police. And so that's what implicated them. When the police were able to get a hold of those two, they both admitted to their parts and they admitted to the killing. And so that immediately kind of implicated, you know, Charles Schmid definitely did this. So Charles Schmid never confessed, but because both Mary French and John Saunders admitted to their part in it and shared the story, then it was obvious that Charles Schmid, you know, did do the murder.
They got him, right.
Yeah. So the Gretchen and Wendy Fritz murder cases, when that went to trial, the trial attorney for Charles Schmid tried to claim that my father is actually the one that killed the sisters. And that was Charles Schmid's defense. And so that was, you know, a lot of people at that time here in Tucson believed that that story could be true or believed it in part. And so, you know, that was very difficult for my father because now there's all these stories that he's actually the real murderer of the two sisters. Of course, there's never any evidence of that. And the judge at the trial shut that down pretty quickly. And so they were really not able to keep trying that defense, but that was their one and only defense for Charles Schmid to claim that my father was the one that really killed the sisters and tried to frame Charles Schmid.
Wow. And that must have turned fast. Did your father consider that that might happen, or did that even surprise him that suddenly he was under the microscope that way?
He didn't expect in the trial for them to try and claim that was his, you know, defense, that my father tried to kill them. Having said that, when my father confronted Charles Schmid at the police station, Charles Schmid started right at that time trying to claim that and saying to my dad, oh, nice frame job, you know, nice job trying to frame me, and was trying to, at that point, you know, tell the police that it was my father who killed the sister. So he knew that that was already what Charles Schmid was trying to say. Again, never any, you know, way to prove that. My father was not the one at the party that night. My father, you know, had a defense and was with somebody else. And, you know, so that was, there was never any truth to the story, but that was what they tried to claim.
Once they've got it in there, how long is it from start to finish for this trial to unfold?
So they first, even though Aline Rowe was the first killing, they first did the Gretchen and Wendy Fritz murder case. And that one was wrapped up just the first of 1966. So about March of 1966 was when they had sentenced him to death. And then the following year was the court case for Aline Rowe. And on that one, the interesting thing is they actually brought in Effley Bailey for that case. And so Effley Bailey at that time was already a very famous attorney because he was he had done the Sam Shepard case, which is, if you've ever heard of The Fugitive, the movie The Fugitive.
Right.
So that was based on the Sam Shepard case and also the Boston Strangler case he had already done. So he was already this kind of big time lawyer. And so Charles Schmid's family brought in Effley Bailey to help with the Aline Rowe case. But pretty quickly, Effley Bailey came into town and pretty quickly made the comment that Charles Schmid, you know, was very insane and convinced Charles Schmid to plead guilty. Later, Charles Schmid claimed that he was coerced by Effley Bailey to plead guilty and tried to take the guilty plea back and ended up finally agreeing to take the police out to where the body was buried. So they never did find Aline Rowe's body leading into the case. But after he pled guilty, he agreed to take everyone out to the bodies or to the body of Aline Rowe to try and prove that their case was wrong and that her skull was not fractured. Because if he could prove that her skull was not fractured, then the story of being hit with a rock would not be true. But after he did take them, but he took them to the body. They unburied the body, and her skull was fractured, and so his guilty, he stood guilty. But so there was a lot of going on in those cases, and you know, another thing for Tucson, it was huge because having Effley Bailey come into town for this case. And at that time, Life magazine did a huge feature and Playboy magazine. And so it was just, at that time, it was really probably one of the biggest murder cases in the nation. It was national news. It was huge.
Yeah, and I would guess. And that had to, what was it like in the community after these crimes are uncovered? I mean, did it just shatter the community and the way they looked at neighbors and one another?
Well, it did, because first of all, you know, because so many teenagers were involved with Charles Schmid, and Charles Schmid was such a hugely popular guy and had so many friends, there was, you know, it kind of affected so many households. And the now understanding that there were a lot of kids that knew the stories, that knew about this, and maybe didn't have specifics, but they all kind of knew something, and nobody was saying anything. And so, and then when you look at the Life magazine article, it really portrayed Tucson as a real seedy town, and it really put a really bad light on Tucson. In fact, I've heard that Tucson, parts of Tucson, they were trying to actually sue Life magazine for portraying them in such a bad light, because it just put such a, you know, it didn't make Tucson look good, that's for sure. But it was a huge black eye on Tucson at that time.
Oh, geez. I can't even begin to imagine what that would be like. And that time, that era, that whole kind of crime and breaking that. I mean, I live in 2018 where crime is rampant, but I live in a nice little quiet town here in the Twin Cities area of Minneapolis, St. Paul. And if something like that happened right down the road, you know, I mean, I lived in Illinois at the time of Gacy, who was nowhere near us at the point. But, you know, when you're from Illinois, everybody's from Chicago, right? So
right.
when you say it, any suburb of that area is a little too close. And I remember, and I was very young at that time, I think I was 10 years old. And I remember just that kind of weight that dropped on everyone as day after day, they uncovered more and more bodies. Now that was a much larger and more heinous crime, but it's still, you know, you feel so insulated until it drops in your neighborhood.
Well, and anybody, you know, you talk to anybody who lived in Tucson at that time or around that time, you know, everyone has a story about knowing Charles Schmid or being a part of this case somehow. And it really is something that really changed Tucson. You know, it really changed it from an innocent, you know, cow town, really, to it put it on the map as everybody knew what Tucson was at that time. And then, you know, the Life magazine titled Charles Schmid the Pied Piper of Tucson. And so that was the title they gave him. And so, you know, Tucson really got thrown into the spotlight in a really bad way.
All right. Now, what was the final outcome for Charles Schmid? Was he eventually put to death? Did he just rot away on death row? Is he still in prison? What can you tell us?
So he was sentenced to death for the Fritz sisters, and then he got a life sentence for Aline Rowe. But then in 1972 or 71, around that time, they commuted his sentence for the death sentence to life because Arizona found the death sentence unconstitutional at that time. And so then he had basically two life sentences. Now, the interesting thing is, once he was no longer on death row, he was treated like any other inmate. And so he was actually able to work off-site and do all kinds of things. Well, in the process, he ended up escaping from prison for, it only lasted a few days. But in 1972, he escaped with another triple murderer, Raymond Hudgens. And they ended up taking four people hostage at gunpoint at a ranch house near the prison.
Holy cow.
They drove to Tempe, Arizona, and then they split up. And Charles Schmid headed toward Tucson. They ended up taking my family. So my father, my mother, and I was just about a year old at that time. But my two sisters and I, we were all put under police protection because it was believed that he may be heading to Tucson to come after my father. They did end up finding Charles Schmid at a rail yard here in town, and within a few days got him. and they got Raymond Hudgens too. So they sent him back to prison. And then in 1975, he was stabbed by two fellow inmates, depending on the report you read, anywhere between 20 and 47 times. So they stabbed him in the eye, the lung, the abdomen, the intestines, face, chest. He was just completely destroyed by these two inmates and ended up dying 1 week later. So he died at the age of 32, March 30th, 1975. He died in prison. It's believed, and it kind of makes sense, that it was a hit that, you know, as I mentioned earlier, the Bonanno crime family got involved in this because of Gretchen's father being the heart surgeon of Joe Bonanno. But when you look at the killing, and there was really, you know, they never gave a good reason for stabbing Charles Schmid, but it's, you know, these two inmates that stabbed him, it's believed that it was probably a mafia hit to get back for Gretchen.
Did your father ever take any heat for the first crime, having not come forward earlier on that?
Oh, of course. So a lot of people, you know, would, you know, the question was always, why didn't you come, you know, forward sooner? And, you know, again, that's where I say, you know, of course he could have gone to the police. The question is, when you really reflect back, what would have happened? So we know that they already questioned everybody. At that time, my father didn't know where the body was, didn't have any real specifics, just knew that Charles Schmid told him that they had killed Aline Rowe. So, you know, I think I could see where my father would be afraid if he went to the police and said that and nothing came of it. That would be a scary prospect as well. I think he was always waiting for the right information that he could go to the police, which is why he convinced Charles Schmid to take him to the bodies that night to bury them, because he wanted to see, where are these bodies? Do they really exist? At that point, he had his proof, but then believed that he had gone too far in trying to help bury the bodies. Then he was afraid that he would, you know, go to prison. And as a young man starting your life out, you are afraid to go to prison. And so I think that, you know, in reflecting back, he certainly...
And for the record, at 51, I'd be afraid to go to prison. So I don't even think it's that beginning of your life stuff. No, I totally get it. I just didn't know if there was any flashback on him from the community, from law enforcement, for not having come forward sooner.
Yeah, and he was treated, you know, he had a very, very difficult time finding work after this happened. And, you know, even when he was in his 40s, so that would have been 25 years after this happened, he went to the U of A to get a teaching degree. And even then, somebody found out who he was, and they pulled him in for an inquisition and almost didn't allow him to continue with his studies at the U of A because of his involvement with these cases. So it always really followed him. And I think we kind of talked at the beginning about how this was always a dark secret that he, you know, always didn't want people to know about, because it did follow him his whole life. He was fired many times as a young man once people found out, you know, that he was involved in these cases. And then there was the flip side, which I never understood, where he was also treated badly for coming forward. So people would go by his home and throw beer cans and, you know, write squealer on his car and things like that. I mean, he was treated badly in both ends, for coming forward and for not coming forward more sooner. And so he went through a lot in those years after, and definitely was punished, you know, for any, you know, mistakes not coming forward sooner, because it followed him for a really long time.
Isn't that weird? And especially in that type of environment, that people would chastise him for doing the right thing, for making sure that justice was served eventually.
Yeah. And actually, the police were able, my father ended up finding out that some of the kids afterwards were planning to kill my father for ratting on Charles Schmid.
Holy shit, Lisa. Yeah. What part of town do you guys live in that everybody's first reaction is somebody's got to die?
Yeah. And so I think it's really interesting to realize
I wonder if are these the people then that were out there drinking beer and partying? And were they just afraid that by your dad's implication in getting Charles finally put away, Schmidt might flip and start ratting on everybody else?
And it very well could be, or it could just be to the fact that, you know, I think it goes back to show the following that he had, you know, to be labeled the Pied Piper of Tucson. It was really a good label, because that was what was happening here. For some reason, he had this following, and these people were so, you know, drawn to him and protecting him. And for my father to rat him out, instead of, you know, treating my father like, oh, somebody came forward, thank God you came forward, it was more like, you know, treating him like the rat and, you know, coming up with a plan to kill him. So it was just crazy.
Oh, unbelievable. Unbelievable. Very few stories leave me gut punched like that, but that is just so many weird people, so this cult-like environment of people standing up for a killer, and yeah, that your dad suddenly was in the crosshairs of other people because he did the right thing.
Right.
And then I'm sure he had people that wanted to kill him for not coming forward quicker.
Yeah. And, you know, at the time, that was one of his fears, too, is that Charles Schmidt did have such a following that he was afraid of a backlash for coming forward. So there were so many things that he was afraid of that you can kind of look back and see why he was frozen and didn't know what to do.
Completely.
Because, yeah.
So for all of you that spent the first part of the show rolling your eyes and huffing and snorting about how you would have done this and you would have done that, just bear in mind that in the long run, your dad was almost Serpico, right? He's got the bad guys above him, the worst guys below him, and doesn't know, you know, any way you turn, you're putting yourself into harm's way.
Yeah, it was definitely a mistake of a friendship to get involved in. That's for sure. It changed his life forever.
Wow. Completely unbelievable. I can't thank you enough, Lisa, for coming forward to share your father's story. The book, I, a Squealer, the Insider's Account of the Pied Piper of Tucson Murders. We will we put a link up to that book as well so you can find
Great.
It. And people can find it right on today's program. Thank you. And thank your father for doing the right thing and releasing
will.
The story.
Thanks for allowing me to come on and share the story.
It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Wow. That's a lot to wrap our head around, Tim. And, you know, I guess that's why I'm glad at this point we can always turn to our cure-all. It's time to look at dumb crimes and stupid crime.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right. Now, Tim, obviously you have the story that may trump all other stories, but there's a lot of dumb stuff going on in Florida this week. And a story that I'm going to round out because I've had everybody, including the Pope, send me this story too. That's right. The Pope.
The Tim. Pope?
Yes. Pope John Paul George Ringo emailed me this story himself and wanted me to share it because he felt it would be good for your dumb crimes, stupid criminals. So we're going to read that one last, and it's out there. But you've got a true crime, dumb crime, really stupid criminal story regarding our buddy Chris Jericho and his band Fozzy. What happened?
Well, this happened last night, Dave, and believe it or not, I was shocked because, you know, there's a Facebook group out there. We were just on the Rock and Wrestling Rager at Sea, and the group that's on there posted this story from StillRealToUs.com that Chris Jericho's life is unpredictable, to say the least, and the former WWE champion has more than a few interesting stories to share about his time in and out of the ring. Chris is currently on tour with his band Fozzy. He's doing a Canadian tour right now, and they tend to get a little rough and tumble in Canada. As you know, Dave, they're rough and tumble people.
Do I? Yeah.
They were in Regina, Saskatchewan last night performing with Fozzy. Dave Meltzer noted on his Wrestling Observer Radio that after the gig, a fan who did some work for the show earlier was trying to get on the tour bus in hopes of getting autographs from the band.
I'm with the band. It's cool. I'm with the band.
And he ended up injuring. Hey. Yeah. And, you know, that tends to be, you know, people have this line that they like to step over. They're habitual line steppers, Dave. And they like to do that to try and get autographs every once in a while. And he ended up injuring Fozzy crew member Jack Slade. Now, Jack is the nicest guy in the world. He's a skinny little guy. He's got glasses. He's got this beard. And he's just very unassuming. But they ended up injuring Fozzy crew member Jack Slade and breaking his collarbone, the poor guy.
Jeez.
Yeah. There was apparently a kid who helped play or did some drum work on the show, and the kid wanted to get on the tour bus and get autographs or something, Meltzer said. I guess they don't want him on, and he ends up somehow sneaking on, and one of the guys on the crew saw him, and they got into a fight, and the guy actually ended up with a broken collarbone because of the fight, and then he gets kicked out. That's when Chris got involved. Are you ready for this?
Probably not, but hit me.
Okay. So Jericho gives him a spear. Yes, these moves actually work. People, don't try this at home. Chris gives him a spear, and he's pounding on him from the mounted position, Meltzer added. The people who were there watching this tried to hold the guy down until the police arrived, and then he got away. The police ended up catching him, however. A source told Loudwire that the man who tried to get onto the bus was on meth. The guy was on meth and barged on the bus for an autograph. He was told he couldn't just come onto the bus and to wait outside as Chris's family was on the bus. He wouldn't leave, and he took a swing at Jack Slade. He then pulled Jack off the bus. Yes, I did say that correctly.
Uh-huh.
And Jack landed hard and broke his collarbone. Chris then chased the guy and tackled him. Then security came and called the cops. The guy ran away and jumped a fence and got caught on some barbed wire. That could hurt. Yeah.
Oh.
Then got in his car and hit a security guard. Cops got him and charged him. He'll be going to jail for sure. That's your wild night with Chris Jericho and Fozzy.
Holy, holy, holy.
Yeah. So, folks, there is a line that's drawn when you ask for autographs. Just wait outside the tour bus. Ask whoever's in charge. They'll try to help you. If they can, they can. If they can't, they can't. And I'll let you know this. Chris and Fozzy are some pretty nice guys. If they can accommodate you, they will. You don't have to jump on the tour bus. Oof. Otherwise, you're getting a spear, a jackhammer, and you're going to get pounded.
Chris is a big fella. I don't think I could take one hit, let alone many pummels from Chris Jericho.
Yeah, I would not want to be punched in the face multiple times by Chris.
Mm-mm.
I'll just tell you that right now.
Ooh. Yeah. Oh, Canada. Oh, Canada.
Yeah.
Stop trying to make a run at Florida, would you? They own the dumb crimes. Let's just let them have it.
All I got to say is good catch, Chris. That's all I got to say.
Is that all?
Yeah, good catch, Chris. There's two things to be said, and you could tell it's the wrestler mentality. Is whenever you cross that line, they're gonna take you out, folks. If you jump in the ring and think you're gonna make a scene, you're gonna get your ass kicked. And if you jump on their tour bus when you're a musician, you're gonna get your ass kicked. I don't know. It's the wrestler mentality. You jump in their private space, you're probably gonna get your ass kicked. Just saying.
Oof. Yeah. Good lesson. Good lesson there.
Yeah.
Huh. I wish we could have gotten Chris on the phone to talk to him about this crime.
I know. That would have been fun. Yeah.
That's crazy. Yeah. Well, good on him for doing what it takes to keep his family and everybody else safe, Tim.
Yeah, exactly.
Unfortunately, the same cannot be said for this Florida grandmother who was mistakenly booked into an all-male Florida jail because the staff thought she was transgender.
Ooh.
Yeah, a woman is suing employees of a Florida jail after they allegedly forced her to spend several hours in a cell surrounded by dozens of men because they suspected she was transgender. The Miami Herald reports 55-year-old Fior Pichardo de Veloz had come to Miami from the Dominican Republic to witness the birth of her grandchild back in 2013 when she was arrested at the airport on an outstanding drug charge. Her arrest report listed her as female. And Pichardo de Veloz was booked into the Turner Guilford Knight Correctional Center, processed as a woman. She was even strip searched. But due to her history of high blood pressure, Pichardo de Veloz was examined by a nurse as a precaution. The nurse saw that she had been taking hormone pills and questioned her about her gender. Despite Pichardo de Veloz's denial of being a man, the nurse added a note to her file that read, transgender, male parts, female tendencies. She saw her naked and still saw male parts. Huh. That might be a really bad nurse.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
The nurse notified a doctor who reclassified Pichardo de Veloz as a male without an examination, according to an appeals court opinion. Pichardo was transferred to the Metro West Detention Center, an all-male jail, sharing a cell with about 40 men who jeered at her, saying, mommy, mommy, according to the newspaper. That's what it says.
Oh, no.
Yeah. She was there for 10 hours and said she was terrified to go to the bathroom and urinated on herself instead.
No.
Jail workers eventually realized her mistake once family members went to the facility where she was originally processed and asked why she was moved. Pichardo de Veloz was removed from her holding cell and given a new examination. During that exam, Pichardo de Veloz claimed several male officers laughed at her and someone had taken a photo. Once her gender was confirmed, she was moved back to the Turner Guilford Knight Correctional Center. Pichardo de Veloz sued the county and jail staff for negligence and cruel and unusual punishment. But the case was thrown out by the judge, who said the jail staffers were protected from a trial for negligence. What? In November, the newspaper reports an appeals court ruled the conduct of the nurse and doctor amounts to deliberate indifference. Every reasonable prison officer and medical personnel would have known that wrongfully misclassifying a biological female as a male inmate and placing that female in the male population of a detention facility was unlawful, Judge Frank Hull wrote in the unanimous opinion. But the people in the jail are kind of clear. I don't understand that rule.
I don't get it either.
Florida comes out, Tim, and when they come out, they stay out. They just blast you with stupidity. We're going to go to Maitland, Florida for our next story. Authorities in Central Florida say a man was stabbed to death by his former housemates over a stolen PlayStation. Seminole County Sheriff Dennis Lemma said 22-year-old Jake Bellotta and 21-year-old Ian McClurg believe that their former roommate, 24-year-old Joshua Barnes, stole their PlayStation. Oh, well, that makes all the difference in the world then.
Sure.
They thought he stole their PlayStation, so he's got to die, Tim.
Well, it's...
What is going on with people? Investigators say the pair lured Barnes to their home they once shared in Maitland under the premise of going to a party and then stabbed him several times with a chef's knife. I might have started the conversation a little different. Hey, Tim?
Yeah, yeah.
You remember when you lived with me?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And when you moved out, my PlayStation was no longer there. Do you know where my PlayStation is, Tim?
No idea, Dave. No
then
idea.
I would stab you, Tim. Then I would stab you.
Well, I
no,
would.
No, I still wouldn't stab you. It just seems maybe you do a little research. I wouldn't just lure you out to a party and then hack and dash.
Hack and dash. I lived there once. It's in New Jersey, I believe.
Yes. No, that's hack and sack.
Oh.
According to the sheriff, as the two were putting the body in plastic bags, their new roommate returned home with a Tinder date and discovered what had happened. That roommate fled and called 911. Bellotta and McClurg were arrested on homicide charges Tuesday. No attorneys are listed on their jail records. Right before I walked out here, we were making the direct correlation to the Deltona case over these gaming systems and things that have little value, no association with the value of human life whatsoever, Lemma told WFTV. This is just absolutely bizarre.
Well, Dave,
how would you like to walk in? Your new roommates are hacking to death your old roommate and putting him in plastic bags. It would make you happy that you walked in on that, so you'd know that you might have been next on the chopping block, literally, eaten their Nutella or something.
Until somebody's taken away your Fortnite, you've never wanted to hack somebody so bad in your entire life.
Wow. I don't even. Well, as long as we're in Florida, let's just go to Newport, Richie.
I've been to Newport, Richie, many, many times.
It all makes sense.
Yeah.
Now,
okay.
You are kind of a Newport, Richie guy, Tim. A Newport, Richie man who was just released from prison was arrested for attempted vehicle theft.
Doesn't surprise me.
Again, before he even left the jail parking lot, Tim.
It doesn't surprise me.
Clade Carpuzzi, 41. That's his name, Clade, or is it Clad? K-L-A-I-D, because it better be Plaid. No. Would it be Plaid or Clade? Let's go with Clade. Clade sounds more like a supervillain name.
Yeah.
Clade Carpuzzi, 41, was arrested when deputies say he tried to steal a truck with a teen in the backseat just 3 days earlier. The fear that my husband and I had to go through on Sunday, you can't explain it, and I just don't want that to happen to anyone else, said Stephanie Seaton, the mother of the teen. As Carpuzzi was walking through the jail parking lot following his release, he reportedly tried to get into a vehicle by walking around it, then pulling on the passenger door handle. Inside the vehicle was an off-duty deputy who happened to be at the jail to take a class. It's kind of odd you would just walk up to a car that's running after you were just arrested for vehicle theft, said a Pasco County deputy on body camera video. He told Carpuzzi that it was no mistake, you're trying to get in with her or you're trying to steal the car. When Carpuzzi pulled on the handle, Deputy Brunner stepped out of the vehicle where she and another deputy detained him. Obviously, there is something wrong and it needs to be looked at a lot deeper than what they've done with the background. It is attached to this man, said Seaton. Carpuzzi told the deputies he saw a vehicle with the engine running and did not realize anyone was in it. He also told them he thought the car was going to take him to his parents. Deputies say he told them he suffers from bipolar disorder. He was arrested for attempted auto theft and returned to jail. Carpuzzi has already been released again. People are scared. People are scared for themselves and for their children, Seaton said. How many felonies do you have to actually commit before they look into you? To me, it just doesn't seem right. I think something needs to be done about it. That's how the article is wrapped up, Tim. And I would agree. So you get out of jail one day for stealing a car.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
3 days later, you're out. You walk into the parking lot of the jail, see a car running, and try to steal that one. I think it might be a cry for help.
You know, having been in that area many, many times, Dave, I could tell you, I don't even feel safe sitting in the Publix parking lot there in Newport Richey. So I would just suggest lock your doors if you're sitting idle in a parking lot. Yeah.
So what is that? Three Florida stories, Tim?
Yeah. Yeah.
Florida stories. Well, I wish we could go away,
well,
but we can't.
The first one was in Saskatchewan.
Right. Yeah. Well, that one, yes, but yeah. I've read three since now in Florida.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And now here's a fourth one, Tim. A woman arrested for crashing a wedding, but they made it seem so fun in the movie, Tim. Owen Wilson and Vince Vaughn.
They did, yeah.
Going to Treasure Island, Florida, where a wedding crasher was arrested in Treasure Island on Sunday. Police said Christine Chandler snuck into a private wedding at the Lions Club. According to the arrest affidavit, Chandler entered the building through a gate on the side and proceeded to the dance floor and began dancing during the last dance between a bride and groom. Police said they witnessed guests trying to physically remove Chandler from the wedding. The DJ told police Chandler was belligerent and refused to leave, causing a scene amongst guests before yelling, "I'm not fucking going anywhere." She is charged with disorderly conduct.
Should be for yelling that.
Yeah. But the picture, her. I have to laugh, Tim, honestly, because her picture is funny because she's very much like, come on, you guys know I'm just jerking her out, right? That's the look on her mug.
Hmm.
Yeah. So that's four Florida stories. But thank God that's it for Florida, Tim.
Huh.
Thank God we're fine. Oh, no.
That's it?
No. No, we're going to go to Miami-Dade County for this next story in a very James Bondian way. Florida Highway Patrol officers arrested Robert Craig Davis, age 70, on November 17th. They say he repeatedly used a remote control device to raise and lower a black cloth shield over his license plate so that toll cameras could not read his plate and send them a bill for using a toll road.
Attaboy.
Davis first came to the attention of CBS4 reporters this summer and to investigators from Miami-Dade Police and the Florida Highway Patrol who saw the report. Motorist Sammy and Maite Salinas shot video of the canny cloaking device when they saw a black cover roll down over the plate, obscuring the numbers as the minivan sailed through a toll on Dolphin Expressway and then rise again to reveal the plate once it cleared the plaza. They sent Miami Herald News partner CBS4 their video of the sliding license plate cover, and law enforcement proved most interested. Miami Beach-based filmmaker Billy Corbin also posted a video clip of the device going up and down over a license plate to his 58,000 followers on Twitter back in June. On Saturday, November 17th, Florida Highway Patrol Lieutenant Alejandro Camacho was off duty but spotted Davis's burgundy Chrysler Pacifica outfitted with a remote control license plate cover as the minivan passed southbound through the Bird Road Toll Plaza on Florida's Turnpike, Tim. Camacho followed Davis's minivan in his own car and alerted fellow FHP troopers. Sergeant Carlos Vanegas stopped Davis at a mile marker number 6 on the turnpike. According to the arrest report, FHP troopers Vanegas and Dennis Gallo searched Davis's vehicle and found a remote control device that was used to raise and lower the license plate curtain. They also saw a SunPass transponder inside a static shield bag in the Chrysler's glove box. It was not properly affixed to the vehicle's window for use, according to the arrest affidavit. The actions of the defendant showed an ongoing course of conduct with intent to defraud the SunPass toll system. The Detroit-born Davis, who lives in Key Largo, told CBS4's Gary Nelson he did not use a license plate cover to dodge tolls, Tim.
Hmm.
Wasn't me. The immortal words of Shaggy, Tim.
Wasn't me.
Like it wasn't me. Oh, different Shaggy. Davis was charged with organized fraud and petty theft and booked into jail. He was released the same day, Tim.
Hmm. I wonder how much it cost to build that little device.
I don't know, but it's well worth it just to get the attention. Tim. Should we stray away from Florida now, Tim? Should
sure.
we go to the rest of the world?
I think we should.
We can't, Tim. We
what?
Can't because it's just too delicious. Florida is just too delicious because a woman passed gas in a store and then pulled a knife on an offended customer.
I think they call it a fart dart, Dave.
A fart dart?
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many people have sent me this story, Tim, from around the world. They they demanded that I read this story. Passing gas in public is often embarrassing, but for Danea Beach woman, doing so while waiting in line at a Dollar General store led to her arrest on a charge of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon without intent to kill. I'm not going to kill you, but I'm going to hurt you. It's what police say she did after a man in line complained about the act that led to the charge. According to Broward Sheriff's Office complaint affidavit, Shanetta Yvette Wilson, 37, was in a checkout line at the Dollar Store in Danea Beach on Sunday evening when John Walker, the customer standing next to her, got into a verbal dispute in reference to the defendant farting loudly, according to the affidavit. Wilson allegedly pulled a small lockback knife from her purse, opened the knife, and told the victim she was going to gut him, the police report said.
Hmm.
While doing so, she pulled her right hand with the knife as if she was going to attack the victim with it, the report said. Walker was in fear that he was going to be stabbed by the defendant, the affidavit read. After police were called, Wilson was found by deputies in the area and identified by Walker. Wilson was arrested and taken to the Paul Ryan Detention Facility in Pompano Beach. Her bail was set at just $2,500. That's all it cost him. $2,500 if you're going to gut someone.
That's it?
Yeah. Almost worth it.
Yeah. Huh.
So you fart in line. First of all, would you, I'm just curious, would you say something? You're in line and somebody just tweaks one?
Yeah.
Would you be like, come on, man, really? Or would you just shake your head and roll your eyes in bitter disgust?
I'd be like, hey, brother, what's with the blowback?
What's with the blowback? The blow dart, is that what you call it?
The blow, a fart dart. Yeah, the fart dart.
Well, Tim, for the next story, we go to Russia.
Oh, that's not Florida.
Crazy things are happening, my friend.
Mm.
Our final two stories are out of country. This one begins in Russia, where a woman who identified as vampire stabbed boyfriend because he was werewolf, Tim.
Well,
werewolf, I said.
They're natural enemies.
Yes. It's almost as bad as moose and squirrel. A woman who thought she was a vampire from a TV show stabbed her new boyfriend to try and fulfill her mission to slay werewolves. But not after she got what she came for, Tim, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Well.
Ekaterina Tereskaya, 22, believed she was Elena Gilbert, the main character in fantasy drama Vampire Diaries, she told police.
Oh, God.
A psychological assessment carried out before the trial in Novosobirsk, Russia, found her to be sane. I think they have very easy parameters in that part of the country.
Boy, they ever.
Tereskaya and her unnamed lover slept together for first time after meeting on social media, the court said. In the morning, she suddenly changed, telling him she was vampire, and like Elena Gilbert, played by Canadian actress Nina Dobrev, had to slay werewolves, Tim. She said he didn't believe in supernatural and urged her to just go home, the court said.
Here's
Baby, the sex was good, but go home. I'm done.
Here's cab
Would
fare.
You make sandwich on way out?
Attaboy.
She grabbed knife in kitchen, suddenly attacked him when he was getting out of bath. Well, I don't blame him. No man should take a bath.
Yeah.
Baths are for girls.
Yeah, man up.
Who wants to sit in a big bowl of miso soup?
That's right. Man up, take a shower.
That's right.
Yeah.
He managed to get hold of knife, but she grabbed another one. Because she's a werewolf slayer, Tim. She brings a backup, but you don't want to know where she hid it.
Well, you're two-fisted. I mean, you know.
She grabbed another and stabbed him in chest. He staggered out of flat and banged on neighbor's doors, pleading for help. Help! Crazy woman, stab me in chest. I meet online for sex. The man was gravely wounded, but survived the February attack. Prosecutor Felix Kunizdasnetov said she was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison after being found guilty of inflicting grievous bodily harm. She was also ordered to pay $3,900 in moral damages to her stabbed lover, Tim. So next time, my friend, you're thinking of getting a little action from online source, make sure, Tim, you don't let her find out you are a werewolf.
That and hide the knives.
The knives, yes, that is a big thing, too.
Yeah.
All right, Tim, this is the story that even the Pope John Paul George Ringo sent to me.
Okay.
Everybody wants this story talked about, Tim. Because this comes to us from Australia, Tim.
Ah.
Would you like me to conquer the Australian accent for this next story?
Please.
Boozy feral pig steals beer, gets drunk, and starts fight with cow. That's right, Tim. Belligerent porker went on a bender after drinking 3 six-packs of beer.
Wow.
Yeah. A booze-pilfering drunken feral pig has caused chaos by running amok at an Australian campsite and starting a fight with a cow.
Put him up.
The belligerent porker went on a drunken bender after stealing and drinking 3 six-packs of beer that had been left out by campers at the De Grey River campsite in Port Hedland, Australia, in the predictable series of events. Tim, it's predictable, of course.
Okay, yeah.
In a predictable series of events that followed, the animal went on a ransack rubbish bins, bags, and anything he could go to find some late-night snacks, as, you know, we would react the same way after having had a drinking, Tim.
Well, yeah.
And then, of course, in the Wisconsin and Minnesota way, Tim, we would look to go cow tipping. That's what Porky here did.
Yeah, well, that's a given, yeah.
But I could go for a Big Mac, and then he wants to go tip a cow.
Yeah.
So he started a fight with an innocent eyewitness cow. I like that it's an innocent eyewitness cow.
Cow had it coming.
What? I was just standing here. What's with the look? The pig is so violent.
So the cow is a cousin of the Snallygaster.
Of course, Tim.
Oh, okay.
They're very close. The cow's much deeper voice, though, Tim.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Following the boorish rampage, the pig decided to swim out in the middle of the river before collapsing drunk under a tree and falling asleep. You and I had many, many nights like this in college, Tim.
I still do, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where we just drink, try to push a cow over,
I do.
Swim halfway across the Mississippi River, go back and fall asleep on the beach.
It's a sad life, Dave.
One camper named Meridia recounted the entire tale to the ABC network. And I will do my best again, Tim, to tackle the very, very beautiful and eloquent Australian accent.
Please do.
It was in the middle of the night, and all these people in the camping opposite us, and they heard this crunching of the can, and they got out their torch and shone it on the pig. And there he was, scrunching away at the cans. Then he went over and raided their rubbish that they had sort of, you know, covered over with a bin as well. And then there were some other people camped right on the river, and they saw him running around their vehicle being chased by a cow. It was going round and round, and then it went into the river and swam across to the middle of the river. the people that were camped on the river went across and crept up on it, and it was hiding and sleeping under a big log, Tim, which is a great song by Robert Palmer.
If I didn't know any better, I would assume that I was listening to the gorgeous lilt of Hugh Jackman.
It is very close. And you didn't even call me out, Tim. Big Log was not by Robert Palmer. It was Robert Plant.
I was going to let the audience assume.
All right.
Yeah.
They crept up on it, Tim, and it was hiding. Mm-hmm. Crikey, have a look at her. She's sleeping under a big log right on the edge of the water.
Right.
Yeah. It was sort of coming from there for a couple of days, but we didn't see it this morning or last night. Of course not. It did the walk of shame. So that was my best female Australian accent that I could pull out for that one. I hope I did him proud.
I think I have a chub. I think I do.
I based it on the famous Australian singer Celine Dion, Tim.
Yeah, well, she is very famous and from down under, if you know any.
Yeah. That's what I've been told.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was a pretty good story, right? A pig that gets drunk and goes cow tipping and then has to take a nap under a big log.
Yeah.
But Tim, I've got one more story.
Oh, sure.
And I guess we don't have to wait to see the final episode of Star Wars, Episode 9.
Who was waiting?
To find out what's really happened, Tim, because Luke Skywalker has landed in jail.
After 8, who was waiting for 9?
Luke Skywalker lands in jail after his arrest in Tennessee, Tim.
Oh, no.
Would you like me to read this story in my best Tennessee accent?
Please, if you would.
The Force was not with Luke Skywalker when he was arrested this week by Tennessee police, according to report. Walker, 21, of Johnston City, Tennessee, was arrested Thursday on a charge of violating probation, WJHL-TV reports. He was on probation in connection with a felony theft charge, the station reports. Walker was being held without bond at the Carter County Jail, according to online records. He was arrested in 2017 on charges of stealing 46 road signs with 3 cohorts. One Han Solo, a Mr. Baca, and a Mr. Lando Calrissian. The Elizabethan Star reported at the time Walker and the others were found with the stolen signs in the back seat of a car after a traffic stop in Carter County, according to the papers. Apparently, Obi-Wan was not with them, Tim, and could wave off the cops. These are not the street signs you're looking for.
My guess is this happened in East Tennessee.
It could be.
Yeah.
Is that where the Cockney accent comes from?
Yes. Yeah.
So that's it. Dumb crime, stupid criminals. For yet another week, folks. Florida, thank you for stepping up. We've been missing you. As a matter of fact, we were about to put out an APB to make sure that it was health and safety on you and that you were still alive and out there and committing stupid crimes. And boy, did you return in spades. So thank you for doing such. And that's it for today. We'll be back again next week with more of the best in True Crime Talk Radio. I'm Dave Schrader, and that's...
Well, I'm Tim Demps. Yeah,
that's me. Yeah, that's you. That's me. And this is True Crime Tuesday.